You're listening to a Rare Drop podcast. Check us out at raredrop.co.
Well, hello, everyone. My name is Rakari Austin, and I'm one of the hosts of GCX 2022. Now, we want you to join us at Rosen Shingle Creek in Orlando, Florida, as we come together for another unforgettable GCX. Tickets are going fast, and look, we want to see you. So visit gcxevent.com/tickets to book now.
Step up your home coffee game. No matter what level of coffee drinker you are, whether you're working from home or commuting, King's Coast Coffee has you covered with freshly roasted coffee shipped straight to your door. We have single origin coffees, custom blends, and three unique espresso blends for the at-home barista. Why spend $6 on a cup of coffee at the other place when you can make top-tier coffee in the comfort of your own home?
Hello, everybody. I'm Ben Bowman, Professor Broman, and I am joined here by Tara Volker. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Tara. Tell us what you do, why you're here, what you'd like to talk about, and why Alan Wake is the best game of all time.
How long is the podcast? How long can I talk about Alan Wake?
As long as
Obviously, my name's Tara, and I'm the Xbox Game Studios Accessibility Lead, which basically means I help all of our first-party studios and by Microsoft make and establish their accessibility goals. I'm also a huge gaming and disability advocate. I myself have invisible disabilities, and I'm also the co-director of the Game Accessibility Conference, which was the first conference ever dedicated to solely the topic of accessibility in video games. And I'm really excited I got to make the transition from only to first, because for a long time we were the only one, but now there are more than one, which is really exciting.
We love it. That's awesome. That is a lot of stuff. As somebody who's co-founded an event, that is a whole undertaking. And then to have like a co-sign under that that says you have any other job, I'm immediately impressed.
I
fully fucking agree. We got started with what is now GCX, and I was like, wouldn't it be fun to take all this attention we have and raise money for charity and then like have a meetup afterwards? And now it's like we got floor plans and security plans, and we got to talk to all these vendors. It's fun.
So there's a whole extra level when you run a conference dedicated to accessibility and disability,
because right.
You want to give people with disabilities like that top tier experience and not all of the hassles that they normally run into at conferences. I mean, that's literally part of the reason we made the conference. And there are so many times we'll go scout venues and places, and like you'll just find like really weird things, like super, super steep ramps. And you're like, who is supposed to get up that? Or there was this one gorgeous venue we were looking at that had like the world's tiniest elevator. And it's like, how does someone in a power chair get in here? Like, what? But also making sure that it's got a good place that you can have interpreters and live captions and all of the stuff that you want to make sure is amazing. And like, frankly, the world's just not always set up for it. And it's,
right.
It's a lot.
It is. And that's the whole reason that you have the conference, is that I really appreciate that you use the term invisible disability when we were talking, because I have ADHD and I have dyslexia. So I have some really powerful things that no one can see that are incredibly disruptive to my life.
Oh, you're a daywalker.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That's what I call it. It's a really unique space, because you kind of have this like extra privilege of being able to quote unquote hide it if you want to. Sometimes it unfortunately can be beneficial, but it's really interesting navigating the space of like, oh, I can choose to disclose or I can choose not to disclose.
Right.
That's why I call it, being a daywalker.
It's definitely, I like to be upfront with folks, because I get the spaces. Like I'll just stare off somewhere, and I just like to let people know upfront. I'm like, if I stare at the wall, I just tuned out for a second. It has nothing to do with you. And I'll be right back. You can like tap me on the shoulder. We can talk a little bit about what it's like working at Xbox Game Studio, but I'm super curious, you know, what led to the founding of your event? And like, how do you feel like it's gone so far? I'm super curious about that.
Yeah. So there were two things that really led to our event. The first was that we had been trying to educate game developers about accessibility in video games, and we kept submitting, we being industry professionals invested in accessibility. And we repeatedly would submit talks to conferences, and they, the biggest piece of feedback we were getting was just like, hey, like, you need to dumb this down. We need 100 level accessibility. Like, you need to still sell people on why accessibility matters. And that was really frustrating because we already had a bunch of people bought into accessibility being important. And so having to repeatedly give essentially, and this is not a joke, the same talk for years and years and years was incredibly frustrating. The second part was that a lot of the game dev events themselves just inherently are not to this day accessible. Even the Game Developers Conference, which is the biggest conference for game developers, they have all of their recordings in something called the Vault. The Vault doesn't have captions. It doesn't. So if you are deaf or hard of hearing, or you prefer to have captions on because they help your comprehension, you can't do it. So it was really frustrating both that the events weren't accessible and that we couldn't do more than sell people on accessibility was important. And then one night after some angry drinks, my co-founder Ian, Ian Hamilton, was like, what if we did it? And I was like, fuck yeah, I'm angry, we're gonna do it. And then I went the next day and realized what I had agreed to, and but then I had already agreed to it, and so here we are. And then, you know, we ended up it's been going great. We've got more and more attendance every year. We've expanded into both in North America and a European edition. And before the pandemic, we were actually looking for a new venue because we had outgrown it, which was exciting.
Oh, so exciting.
It's a great yet terrifying place to be because it keeps growing and I still have a day job.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like if this was in person afterwards, we would like have to go get drinks and tell battle stories about putting on an event with another job.
Look, I'm ready to just drink right now. Like that's
all the time. Yeah, all the time. Putting on an event is definitely like it is incredibly challenging. And at GCX, we definitely we always want to have an accessible event because that's, you know, the event started from a charitable place and we want to make sure, just like St. Jude, their mission, vision and values, everybody's welcome. And we treat everyone and we want to help everyone. And so we wanted our events to be like that. And it is certainly, as you're laying out, it's a challenge, right? And you have to go there. You have to go there with a keen eye and you have to go through and you have to walk through like, okay, like someone's here and, you know, are all signs visible enough for them to read? Because we can't expect them to hear any audio cues or, you know, like what, like are pathways clear enough? Like all of the sort of things that don't get traditional consideration. And I'm actually really shocked to hear that GDC isn't taking the time to make the, well, and I think in general that the industry, the events on side of our industry, we have these really important events. And now it even feels even more like dissonant to me because we have these game studios that are, you know, winning awards, that are really driving forward, you know, like accessibility in their games. And yet when they're going to go present at a conference, they're somewhere that is inaccessible. It feels like a really weird, I don't know the right word. It feels uncomfortable.
It is uncomfortable. Honestly, one of the most powerful statements that I've ever had on a panel was Ubisoft was actually sponsoring a panel and they had people from a few different areas coming to talk. And one of the people who's going to be on a panel, they are a wheelchair user and they had put a little lift to get up on the stage for them, but they never tested it. And so we got there for our panel and the lift was broken. And so we had to lift a person onto the stage to talk about why accessibility was important. Like, it was just like, kid, the irony, I don't want.
Yeah.
I'm just like, of all of the talks to not have tested
right
the ramp for or the elevator for, like, why this one? Like, wouldn't you want this talk to go off without
this? Is the one that really needs the extra attention. And I think that it's great to highlight that, but like that attention should be paid everywhere, which I think is really in my mind, like, I think that it's really incredible to have watched the gaming space, because I've been doing this for almost 10 years. And to watch the gaming space kind of evolve and go through all of the different conversations that it's had. The leading one, or the one that seems to always come up, is the difficulty conversation, or artificial difficulty conversation. Right. It's a huge touch point for me, because it was something I would argue for all the time. Like, when those first conversations were starting to show up while I was streaming, and people were like, oh, you know, well, Dark Souls is just like, it's just hard because it just kicks your ass. And I was like, yeah, but like, what if I'm someone who wants to enjoy Dark Souls? But this idea of like fast twitch, high acuity movement isn't something, or high accuracy movement isn't something that I can do reliably, you know, and how do we craft experiences that are equivalently challenging, but, you know, fit them into an architecture? Because that's the thing, a game is a system, right? So any game can be built into a system that is customizable. And that's really all that's really the start, right? Like, once you can have a customizable interface, that's what I've seen a lot of the successful initiatives when it comes to accessibility, they tend to start there. So like, seeing the conversation go from that to like, oh, of course, and like, let's make sure that we get like, you know, all of the different color blindness settings that we can in here, and let's try to not make fun of people for using easy difficulty or whatever it is. But I would love, that's been my experience. I'd love to know like your thoughts on that.
Oh, I have all of
three of a million.
I have a million. So when thinking about this as a game dev, when you are making a game, you are trying to make a intended level of challenge. And the key to good game design is making sure that the level of challenge equals the reward given to the player at the end. If those things are mismatched, it is not fun. And so you have to, number one, keep in mind that difficulty is relative. I am sure there are things I can do that you can't do, that you can do that I can't do.
Definitely.
And that is just part of life. And so that means that the level of difficulty, or the level of challenge that each of us would face in certain tasks, are different. And so for gamers with disabilities, when that challenge is raised due to factors that the developer did not intend, it becomes more challenging, therefore more difficult, therefore the reward at the end doesn't match. And so when we're talking about accessibility, that's what we're trying to tackle. And a lot of the times we're trying to remove unintentional barriers that add to the challenge. When you're playing a Souls-like game, being able to set up your Xbox adaptive controller with a nice control scheme should not be an additional challenge on top of the rest of the game. And right. a lot of times when you're making games, rather than think about what can you add on to make it more accessible, what could you have done differently to begin with? Like, think inclusively. If you had just made a colorblind friendly UI, you would need to add colorblind options. And then as a dev, you've actually saved yourself work, because now you don't have to add more options. And when we as developers start thinking like that, we can offer difficulty options and inclusive design that put the player at a level of challenge that equals a positive reward that they have fun with. And that's what really is a game design. And that's not at all what we talk about when we talk about difficulty.
No, I love the really clear understanding of the problem, right? It's the end point. How do I make this reward enjoyable for everyone? So you mentioned the Xbox adaptive controller, which is like, that was a life-changing piece of technology, when it came out. I was so excited. Some of my background before streaming, I was an in-home care provider for adults with disabilities. And so, you know, I am like intimately aware of how just a really smart tool can transform somebody's life, give them so much more agency, you know, and control. And in this case, this is what I loved about the Xbox Adaptive Controller. It is literally something that is designed to help you play, and play in all sorts of new ways, and games that people were like, I'm never gonna be able to play that. And then now suddenly you can boot up a Souls-like game, and it's like, oh, cool. Well, I have the control scheme that works for me. What's so speaking of like controls and interfaces and things like that, Things are always moving forward, right? And if we're thinking about Xbox, like the Kinect came out a long time ago, but now at scale, we're seeing AR, VR, you know, interfacing coming into play. It's maybe not, you know, it hasn't replaced an Xbox controller yet. What kind of things do you see on the horizon when it comes to accessibility and the utilization of that sort of new technology?
For me, AR and VR is a really interesting space because at its basis, it assumes that you have certain movements available to you that not everyone has.
You're great at just showing the like bias I didn't know I had. Like, this is awesome. I'm learning so much.
It's literally my job. That's all I do. Is be like, thank you for thinking you're inclusive, but let me body check you right now. But no, so both AR and VR assume that you can do some certain things that not everyone can, which is totally fine. The point of designing all these features is you have to be intentional about what you're doing. You have to be intentionally inclusive, otherwise you will be unintentionally exclusive. So for AR and VR, we really have to think about, okay, we can't assume everyone has head tracking that they're able to do. This is a fact. Not everyone can turn their head, but they have arm strength. So what other options do we allow there? There are still, honestly, in VR and AR, problems that I just hit as a woman who is short. As someone who is 5'3", there are still video games that I play that they just literally, like, I will get motion sick because it was developed by a dude who's 6'1". And like me trying to move in that space when I am used to being much lower, like, literally will make me sick. And so we still have to honestly just get more inclusive in all regards in AR and VR. And honestly, it's a space that I'm not great at because, like I said, I get motion sick super easy. I get motion sick in cars sometimes. Not sometimes, very frequently I get motion sick in cars. I won't hide this. And games make me motion sick frequently already. So AR and VR is like a space that I'm not really involved in because I don't enjoy puking.
So we still have a lot more learning. That's really interesting. Because AR and XR is so, like, they're so new, that the consideration hasn't even begun yet. I'd love to talk a little bit about, you know, what it's like, maybe not like with Xbox Game Studios specifically, but like, how does one go about making and establishing goal sets, you know, to push forward, to push forward, you know, advocacy for the, you know, for inclusion, for accessibility. Because, you know, it's one thing to talk about like, oh, we would love this. It's a completely other thing to like sit down in a corporate environment and be like, all right, here's the key results. Here's our objective. You know, here's our corporate talk. So what is it like transforming? Because I think this, you're at a unique intersection here, this passion and incredible insight that you have into, you know, a traditionally corporate environment at Xbox and still getting the advocacy and the kind of results that you're looking for. I'm fascinated by that.
It is an incredibly interesting space to work on. And honestly, it varies depending on who you're talking to. The biggest thing that you need to be able to do when having a job like mine is adapt your talk track to whoever you're talking to. We talk a lot in accessibility about the accessibility journey, and there are different, you know, maturity models that you can go and look at and reference. And it's basically every person, every organization will go through this process of thinking about accessibility, knowing about accessibility, acting on accessibility. And what you have to do is identify who you're talking to is in that process to figure out what you need to serve them to get them to that next step. You know, when working with a whole bunch of studios, like, I can't treat, you know, compulsion the same way I'm working with 343. Their work culture is different. Their size is different. Their scope of project is different. And so you really have to tailor it to make sure that you're doing the right thing. And in terms of getting buy-in, it can actually be really easy depending on the org that you're at, especially with a lot of the data that we have out there now. For example, like, there's data out there that shows that accessibility features have led to better retention, even for non-disabled players. like when Control, another game I absolutely love, and not just because of the Alan Wake DLC, added their assist mode, they actually put out data that showed that players who turned on their assist mode were more likely to complete the campaign than those who did not. And so when you are able to show numbers like that, that show that, hey, by investing in these accessibility features, we are also helping what is considered, quote unquote, our core player base, you will have better returns. If people complete the game fully, they're more likely to buy DLC. And so although I don't like bringing it to the money place, the fact of the world is this is a capitalist society. But we do have the data that shows that that's where we need to go. If just being a good person isn't like the reason you want to do accessibility, fine. There are financial reasons too.
I'm a huge proponent of that, right? You have to play the game that you're in. That statistic's mind blowing. For everyone in the studio has to feel better about knowing like this incredible narrative, soundtrack, gameplay, enemy design, whatever it was that I was a part of. And like Control is a great example because I love that game. And the finale of that game is like gripping. It doesn't let go. You can't believe what the fuck's happening. And to be able to walk in and say, you know, X% of players are going to be able to experience that moment, X% more, just because you added this feature. And the feature is for everyone. That's really cool. And then to take it back to the, okay, we've got to make money. You know, that's the kind of margins that people operate on, right? Like if you can say, oh, it's going to be a flat 5% boost to your bottom line, they're going to go, oh, that's smart. That's worth the man hours and like the dev time and all the personnel to like finish this stuff out. Holy cow. What game do you feel like really nailed accessibility features?
Ooh, so
like I don't know if you have like a personal gold star that you'd give to a game.
I am biased.
Okay,
as a person
fair.
Who works in game dev.
Sure, it can also be your game. No one's gonna judge you here.
I mean, we can judge me. Let's be clear. I wouldn't care if you did. But like right now, I'm really excited about Forza Horizon 5. I know that it's not a game that everyone in the world can play. But way more people can play 5 than can play 4. We have much more options. We had an entire process of including people with disabilities in literally from like the concepting phase. Like we were finishing up Forza Horizon 4, like the last patches, when we started talking to players with disabilities about what they want to see in Forza Horizon 5. And like, if you scroll back far enough in my Twitter feed, like you can see the original picture that like proves the snapshot in time of when we started talking. Cause we brought people to the office and I took a picture with everyone. And now we are getting ready to launch fairly soon American Sign Language and British Sign Language as an option for the cinematics. And I can't think of another game that has done that. And so
that's awesome.
I am so excited. I can't wait for it to go live. We're very, very close. We almost got it in for the base game, but we wanted to make sure it was absolutely perfect. So we announced it at game launch to let people know it was coming, and we're close to it actually being live. So super excited.
So just trying to introduce sign language into that kind of environment is so challenging. I don't know if you can talk about it yet, but yeah, there had to be a lot of technical, because like you're looking at a high movement environment, right? And there's like all these colors, there's all these like elements of the HUD, right? So like how do you couch
language in all that? For us, so we're only doing it in the cinematics, the story part, the cutscenes.
Okay.
To be honest, trying to do sign language in gameplay itself is like, we didn't really try to do that because like people who use sign language like don't try to have a conversation while driving to begin with. So it seemed like
makes sense.
You know, like dangerous. Like you wouldn't tell them to like talk to the person in the car with them in real life. So like, why would you do that in the game? Because if you're looking at the interpreter, you can't like look at the road.
Right.
Versus like subtitles, you can just like have that very little eye tracking movement and get it. But we're starting with the cinematics, and again, we're really excited, and the people who do all of the interpretations are amazing. They even have like little Horizon shirts on with like the pink logo and stuff. It just makes me so happy.
I'm really looking forward to that. That is so, you're doing so much cool stuff. Like, you're like really, I guess for me, like I was saying earlier, like I feel like grizzled sometimes being in gaming for 10 years, and to just see all of this stuff actually happening in games now is so cool. And and the discussion is just about like, how do we do this and then better next time? And it makes my heart so happy. So to the point of all of that, you know, what was it for you? I want to talk a little bit about your career path. So like, what got you started on the path that you're on right now? Like, what, how does one end up in your position?
Yeah, so this is a convoluted story with two parts.
I love it.
So my accessibility journey and my game dev journey were not the same journey for a very long time. So it actually, if we were to go back to wee little Tara of about 10 or 11 years old, I was walking home from school one day when a woman ran a stop sign and hit me while I was in the crosswalk. It was obviously what is referred to as a traumatic injury. I broke several bones. It was a whole thing. And while I was recovering, the only thing I could really do with my friends was play video games. My hip was broken, so I couldn't walk. My arm was broken, so I had to hold the gaming controller weird. But like, it is what I could do. It took work, but it was what I could do with my friends. So it was really important to me during my recovery. Flash forward, and I'm attending University of Illinois studying biochemistry, and I don't have enough credit hours to get my financial aid. So I took, because I'd always loved video games, a class that I'd been told was really easy, that it was only one credit hour that I could quickly take so I could get my student loan. And while I was in that class, the professor was the then chairperson of the International Game Developers Game Accessibility Special Interest Group. So in her game design class, she talked a lot about accessibility. Mm. And it clicked with me fundamentally because of my experience that I'd had as a child. I got it. Like, I understand like why gaming is a huge socialization tool, how it was great for my confidence, how it literally helped me with pain management. Like, the benefits of gaming clicked. Also, remembering how awkward it was to hold that controller also clicked. Like, I fundamentally got it. It was only a short time period in my life, but I definitely understood more than the other people in my class. She was just a badass lady. I stayed in contact with her, even though, again, I was going to be a magical medical researchist who cured cancer or something, probably. But I ended up obviously not doing that. And by complete happenstance, wound up working in video games, which is a whole other story about being a babysitter. But it ends up with me with an entry-level job at a game studio. And I was talking to her about, oh, I got a job in games. Like, this is so cool. I learned so much from you. And she's like, oh, great. And you know about the problems with accessibility, and you know the industry isn't there culturally, and now you're on the inside. So what are you doing to change it? And I was just like, oh, shit. And that's how it started. At first, it was very overwhelming. And I was kind of like her apprentice, I guess, just kind of following her around. And basically, she had told me that the industry's knowledge of accessibility in gaming was so low that by knowing it was a problem, I already knew more than everyone else. And I didn't believe her. And then very quickly, I realized that she was right. And
what time period was this like in gaming's history?
Oh, this was 2009, 2010.
Oh God, yeah, no, nobody was paying attention. No,
like maybe somewhere around then, and that's what started me down the path, and it was you very quickly become the expert when no one knows anything. And then, yeah.
And then you just keep going. And then you end up.
Well, and for a long time, you know, accessibility jobs in gaming, like those weren't a thing. So it was always like, I'm going to weasel my way into a position where I can affect it, which is like, I'm going to be a producer or a systems designer. I'm either going to be the one making the system or the person in charge of the schedule for the system to make sure that there's time allotted. And that was pretty much what I did for a long time until the industry caught up to where I was and then realized that someone should do this full time.
That's, I love that blueprint to advocacy that you just like broke down there. Like, I'm here, I know what's going on, I know it's important, so I'm just I'm gonna build it into the job that I have right now so these goals get accomplished. I think that's, God, that's so cool. Like a spy, like a superhero spy, like, oh yeah, yeah, we're making the world a better place, you don't even know it. I think that I you know, a lot of folks listen to this podcast, you know, it's people who are in traditional jobs, right? You have a normal, you're in a quote normal non-gaming job, or you're in a corporate setting, and it's like, I definitely felt like when I had jobs like that, I felt very disempowered. Like the things I was passionate about, I couldn't bring them in to scope. I couldn't be like, oh hey, you know, Starbucks, like, let's do this, right? Like, no, like, you're a barista, shut the fuck up. You know, so I think that it's really interesting that you were able to affect change in that way. For anyone else that might have intersectionality like that in their job, what did you have to do? Did you have to sell that around to, like you were talking about earlier, to like, you know, your higher ups and say, hey, I'm going to prioritize this because it's going to be valuable for us? Or was it like on the down low, like, oh, we're going to do this?
Well, so it was a bit of both. As I mentioned before, you have to know the system you're working in.
Right.
And like, there were times it was just on the down low. Like one time, this is not a joke, on one project I worked on, I had a UI dev who was like obsessed with fancy teas. And I also love tea. Like I even have like a tattoo of a teacup on my arm. And I was just like, look, I will get you the hookup of like this really great tea. I'm going over to England. Like, I will come back and I will slide you some of this magnificent tea if we're able to get these colorblind filters in by this day. And like, it wasn't on the schedule. We didn't talk about it. We didn't bring it up. It was not in his approved sprint. As a producer, am I ashamed that I was telling devs to work outside of their sprint? No, because no one caught me. But there are other places I worked. Like, for example, I worked on Evolve when I was at Turtle Rock, and Chris and Phil, the studio heads, like, I knew if I went to them with like my case, that they would give me a fair shot. And honestly, like, going to them, I got on like slide 3 of my deck, which was like, we should be good humans. And they're like, okay, great, here are your resources. At which point I was really upset because I worked really hard on that deck and we only got to the third slide. But it really did depend on like where I was and the culture. But honestly, like, the most important thing is to realize like, you can't do it alone and you will need allies. So whether you are forming a secretive group who all collectively work on it together outside of like official job duties, or you are partnering with, you know, your higher up people to make it a more corporate initiative, you can't do it alone. You will find someone who will want to help you, especially if, you know, you're working on pretty much any of the causes for underrepresented groups. Someone will be able to relate. Someone will have a friend or family member they care about that the message will resonate with. All you have to do is find them and let them know that if you work together, you can be empowered to affect change. And that's the biggest thing.
That's really cool. This is like one of my favorite interviews I've ever done. I'm like learning so goddamn much right now. So going back to like, I guess this makes sense. What do you think, what are some things that you'd love to see happen in the space over the next like 2 years? What are some like general improvement things that you're like, man, I think we're on pace to do like this or that, and like, I'd love to see it happen. You know, what can we be looking out for and advocating for ourselves? You know, what are some projects we can be looking forward to?
I think in gaming accessibility, one of the things that we really need to work on is, number one, breaking away from like monoliths in difficulty options. Because a lot of times, like, I as a player don't want everything to be easier or everything to be harder. Like, I actually love, for example, in the Tomb Raider games, when you adjust the difficulty, you can change the combat, puzzles, and exploration difficulty independently. So maybe I'm a complete badass at puzzles and I'm just really bad at combat. I shouldn't have to have like the easier version of the puzzles, which do not present a challenge for me, just because I am not good at headshots. So like, how do we basically offer these difficulty levels as like presets that can then be tuned independently rather than just these huge chunks? That's one. And then the other thing we're starting to see it and I want to see more is inclusive design. Like I mentioned earlier, like don't add colorblind modes at the end, figure out how you could have just made an accessible UI to begin with. You know, don't add a high contrast mode, figure out how you could have made a more high contrast yet appealing UI from the beginning. You know, how do we just roll that in? We're starting to see bits and pieces of it. And I think we are heading that way as an industry. I just want to like put us on a fast track, like, you know, Tokyo speed train and get there faster.
Yeah, I like the idea of being able to more fine tune your difficulty experience so much, because that, I think everyone can get on board with that, right? Like that is a value add for everybody. That's a value, like, you know, maybe I'm playing a game and like I need to play it on the easiest difficulty because I'm not awesome at combat, but I would prefer to not have everything just disintegrate after two punches, right? Like maybe I want to bump the health up so I can actually feel, you know, the battle flow of the game. For me, like the culprit that I'm thinking of right now is God of War, right? Like I played that on like easier difficulties because that's just like I'm not good at those kind of games. But when you're on that difficulty, unless you're fighting something that's like four levels above you, you just chunk everything's health out. You're getting all these upgrades and you never use them. You're like, why would I use this? I could just, you know, throw the axe through his head from across the map. So I like the idea of fine tuning various difficulties. And to me, it feels like what's the right word here? I guess the experience, like the overall level of knowledge and of systems that the gaming space has now is really going to open up. Like, I think, you know, maybe 10 years ago, that might be a bit of or 15 years ago, 20 years ago, a bonkers idea to be like, oh, we have like these fine tuned difficulty settings, like we'll crank up the AI here and then we'll have alternate sets of puzzles and we'll have all this other stuff. And it's like, now
I don't think it was, though. That's the thing. As a game dev,
you definitely know more than I do.
these are all options that we're using as a game dev anyway. Like one of my biggest game dev pro tips, I'm like, hey, that debug command that you're using to make your life easier, like, could you just slap some UI on that and let the player choose? Because there's so many times as dev that like we're artificially inflating our health or we're artificially lowering enemies' health. Like those are all values that are already able to be tuned. They just were never exposed to the player like that.
Huh.
So like just start exposing things that we're already tuning. Cause you have to think, if you're balancing a game,
right?
Like you're going in and changing those numbers anyway. Like if you have difficulty settings, you already have the ability for it to be variable in some factor, like just literally slap a UI on top of that stuff that you already have.
Crack it open a little bit more and like let the players see it. Shit. Well, what the fuck, game dev? This is ridiculous. I'm about to start sending some angry letters filled with home-baked cookies so they know that I still care about them in their game. Aww. Thank you for the game, but do better. So for folks that are new, and you talked about this a little bit earlier, you know, there's like different milestones on people's journey with understanding this, right? Like, first of all, they're completely unaware. You know, and I don't think anyone's completely unaware after this podcast. But what would you encourage folks to do if they're listening to this and they're like, oh my God, I'm totally in. I see the value in this. What is the next step to somebody who just learned about this? What are some good resources, et cetera? Yeah.
So honestly, a great place to start is just to be a little more inclusive and accessible at your work. Like, how many of us send emails on a day-to-day basis? There are tools out there that can make things more accessible. So obviously this is going to sound like a Microsoft shill, but if you use Outlook, for example, there is like a check accessibility option on literally your emails to make sure that your emails are accessible or that your PowerPoint presentations are accessible. Literally think about those little things day to day. And honestly, depending on where you want to go in your accessibility journey, there are tons of events out there on any sort of topic. If you want to learn about tech accessibility, game accessibility, physical space accessibility, there will be a conference somewhere. Obviously, I'm partial to the Game Accessibility Conference, European edition, happening on April 11th and 12th. But who am I to tell anyone to do anything specific? But honestly, again, not to sound like a Microsoft shill, I want to say I went to this conference before I worked at Microsoft. Every May, Microsoft has the Ability Summit, which has some really great talks on a variety of topics. And so if you really just want to hear more from people with disabilities themselves, because it's very important to hear about their challenges from them and their voice, it's a great place to start.
Do both of those things, everyone who's listening. You better buy a ticket and fly to Europe. Maybe not right now. I don't know.
It's going to be
in-person, digital.
It's going to be digital. We wanted to do in-person for this event, but unfortunately, right around the time we would have had to put the money in for the venue was like massive peak Omicron over there. And we were like, this is not a time we feel like putting money on a venue that we can't get a return for if we have to cancel.
Yep.
So we chose it safely and went online. But also, you know, being a conference with accessibility and a disability focus, we have a higher number of attendees who have compromised immune systems than normal events. So we are a zero risk crowd. Like, we do not want someone to get sick and suffer because we wanted to yak about video games.
Right. Yeah. I can understand and relate to all of those really difficult decisions. This has been awesome. So let's talk about Alan Wake. Yes. because I'm super interested, because, you know, most, like, I played that game, I was incredibly impressed. It was a very different experience for me, you know, and it's my favorite because I feel like they nailed Lovecraftian atmospheric style horror in a way a video game had not done before. But what do you like about it?
What don't I like about it? No, so I'm into narrative-driven games. I'm into horror. I'm into psychological thriller. I'm in love with Barry. I love so much about the game, and I really liked the setting, the characters, and when they did the remaster, I was incredibly excited because I literally, this is not an exaggeration, I have gone on like sprees of like giving out 10 copies of Alan Wake, like in the past, because like I would be streaming playing Alan Wake and everyone's be like, oh, what's this game? I'm like, this is an old game from the 360. It's one of my favorites. And they'd be like, oh, it's, and they're like, I've never heard of it. And I'm like, oh my God, well, it's on sale for $2 or $5. And be like, yep. I'm giving away 10 copies. Cause I, whatever, like I can do that. And then, yeah, then they had the remaster, which had amazing subtitles. If you haven't checked out the remaster, crank the subtitle size all the way up. They're easily the largest subtitles I've ever seen in a video game. It's amazing. But, like, honestly, so I was literally talking about Alan Wake today, which I do every day, but today was special because I was actually talking about it from an interesting accessibility perspective. So as you play, Alan is, you know, narrating things around him, the thing he sees, the environment, the vibe. There was one time where I was streaming Alan Wake and one of my people chatting with me was blind and they had no vision, so they couldn't see the game. But because Alan is narrating everything that's happening, they thought it was a really cool stream for them to be a part of and watch because they could hear like what was happening in the character's voice. So it was like a fun accidental accessibility feature. It was almost like live audio descriptions in a game, But that's what I was talking about today, and I'm really excited for Alan Wake 2. I'm so pumped.
That's so interesting. It's interesting to think about how they did just that, right? Like the audiobook format, because it fits the overall vibe of the game, right? You want to know, well, you know, they didn't have to do it, right? There's plenty of other horror games where you don't get the narration from the main character trying to solve problems, but they do such a good job of taking you through his journey with his voice, and all that discovery is part of it. That's so funny. I love that you were talking about it today, about accessibility. That's incredible.
I talk about it literally
every day, all the time.
I don't know how I do it, but like someone will say something, I'll be like, you know what? That reminds me of an Alan Wake. And people are just like, stop, Tara. We get it.
We don't need to hear.
You're a fan, and you also really like Control, and you're really excited about the DLC. And yes, we called to check on you after the Alan Wake 2 announced because we want to make sure you didn't have a heart attack, but we don't need to hear about it today. So I have, this is not a joke, like 8 of these Alan Wake posters from the original Xbox launch. And the reason I have them was because I am such a vocal Alan Wake fan that one day at my office, someone was cleaning out a storage closet somewhere in the depths of the Xbox basement and found all of these posters. And I was not in the office that day. I came back. They had covered my walls. They taped into my monitor. They taped into my chair. Like, my entire office was covered in Alan Wake posters. I was like, joke's on you. I left half of them up literally until I had to move buildings, go to a different office.
Yeah, that's a... I have so many questions about your background right now while you're talking. Like, I see like there's like a miniature door back there. I love the Jurassic Park.
That this was a birthday present. That's the scary storage area we block off so the evil, I assume dolls, because that's what I feel like would fit in there, are. This is a Silent Hill 2 patches slot machine. It's the last officially licensed Konami game. I had that imported because... as an adult with no children,
right now. I'm like, I am like loving everything that you have back there. Yeah, I have. Sorry, Paul. The podcast is over. We're just going to show each other cool shit. I have my Mass Effect helmet, which I really like. And then I got this from the Godfall folks, which I was like really impressed. They were like, look, we made this. And I was like, oh my God, I love it.
That's amazing. The game had more longevity for you.
This has been awesome. I have learned a tremendous amount. We're kind of coming up on the end of our time. So before we sign off, I just wanted to kind of give you the floor. We've been talking about a lot of stuff today, but anything that you want to pitch, any kind of final words, takeaways you want people to have, now's the time.
Yeah, so honestly, the biggest thing I want people to do after this is just think about little ways that you can be more inclusive and accessible in your day-to-day life. If you want to learn more about video game accessibility, you can check out the Game Accessibility Conference. We're going to be having our European edition in April, the 11th and 12th. We also have all of our videos from all our previous conferences, like all of them ever, online on our YouTube channel. So you can also check that out if you want to go back and look at some of the older talks. And we've got everything from, you know, AAA titles like Last of Us 2 to solo indie devs making their game completely blind accessible. So this has got a little bit of everything. And, you know, I hope you get to check out the ASL and BSL in Forza Horizon 5 when that launches soon. And that's all I got.
That's going to be awesome. Well, thank you so much. And for me, hi, you know me already. I'm Professor Broman. This is my podcast you're listening to. Thanks for listening. You can leave a review if you'd like, but more importantly, we do this so that we could spread awesome information to folks. So if you thought about anybody today while you were listening to this podcast, please just share this with them. That would mean the world to me. And so from me and everybody here, I don't know why I'm talking like I'm on SNL right now. From me and the rest of the cast, thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.